Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Alvis Smith, welcome.
Hello, Brendan.
And congratulations. So last Friday, you received the French Legion of Honour, the highest order of merit that France bestowed. So you joined the likes of, I was having a look, Marlene Dietrich, Celine Dion, Salvador Dali, Miles Davis, and the list goes on and on. So I suppose it is a fitting recognition of your life in social justice activism as a feminist, a socialist, an LGBTQ plus activist. And you were the founder too of the Women's Education Research and Resource Centre in UCC. How did it feel to get the honour?
Well, it was absolutely extraordinary and amazing. And to be even mentioned in the same breath as Marlene Dietrich, it feels as if all of my dreams have come true. But it was genuinely really an incredible sense of gratitude and fulfillment. And I don't know, there was something very special about it because it was, for me, completely unexpected. I never thought, you know, as a girl growing up in Ireland and as a young girl beginning to learn French and to, I suppose, really fall in love with France, you know, I could never have expected that this really extraordinary honour would be ever bestowed on me. And perhaps particularly because I don't need to tell anybody, you know, I've kind of lived my life as a bit of a thorn in the flesh. As a radical in any country, I suppose, but, you know, just thinking back about the history of Ireland and what we've been, the kinds of oppression that we've been pushing back against over all my lifetime, really, I could never have expected to be honoured.
And yet, I was looking back, that's why it's so amazing. I was looking back on your life, and it really is, your story is kind of the story of the modernising of Ireland as well. You've lived it all. I think your journey into activism and your awakening, if you will, kind of started in your 20s, didn't it? You suffered from anorexia and depression. Tell me about that.
Well, I think what happened to me was I was the first girl in my very large, extended, but also very middle-class family to be able to go to university. And there were, I think, unspoken maybe, but very big expectations. And I think I began to feel quite a lot of pressure. And I did develop anorexia very, very seriously and very severely in my early 20s. And I then got married because, you know, I was raised in a convent to think of myself as getting married and having children. But at the same time, the really very good nuns who raised me, educated me there, were also educating me to have a career as a young middle class girl in Ireland in the 1950s. Whatever that was, late 50s and into, well, the late 1950s. I was the first generation of middle class girls who were really seeing that as a possibility. It all became too much. I got anorexia very shortly after I got married. I got married when I was 24. I was married for about 6 months and I just became very ill. And the rest of my 20s were spent dealing with that, trying to get better, in and out of St. Patrick's. And
well, what was the treatment was very different back then, I'd imagine.
Yes. You got a lot of ECG treatment.
Really?
Electroconvulsive therapy. There was some talking treatment that began to come through, a lot of drugs. So really, you know, for the six or seven years, I think I was really very ill, Brendan, and I just think
ECG
I'm so lucky.
ECG is looked back on now as a quite a brutal treatment.
Yes, I remember it very, very well, and it does strange things to your memory. So, you know, as I get older, my memory becomes less clear. I have to say, I'm trying to say it's because of all the ECT I had when I was younger. But, I mean, it does have an impact on you, and I think that whole experience when I began to emerge from it, It taught me something very important, because when I was in St. Patrick's, I had started, I suppose, really just becoming aware that this was somehow not my fault, that it was an illness, that I wasn't actually mad, that I didn't have to be somebody that people silenced. There was a kind of silence.
Was there a silence around it?
Yes, absolutely.
Like your family, for example, would they have been ashamed of it? Well, no disrespect to them,
it was very
difficult.
It was very difficult for my parents. I mean, I think they dealt with it really quite well, but it was really very difficult, and it must have been very difficult for my younger family members. People didn't talk about mental illness in those days. And I mean, I don't want to try to make out that this changed me forever. But actually, it kind of did. You know, it really did, because it woke me up as well. As I began to get better, I began to realise that other things were happening in the world. And one of them was the women's liberation movement. This was during, you know, the very early 1970s.
Yeah.
And that was... it was the women's liberation movement, and learning about that, hearing about what happens to women under patriarchy, that actually, it was like, you know, it was the Prince Charming who woke me up.
Yeah.
Charming.
I think specifically was it, so you, as you say, you were married briefly, I suppose was the thing to do. But then you had a child, as we used to say, out of wedlock. And I think this galvanized you too, because you're a child. This is a word we used so casually until quite recently in this country. Your child was illegitimate.
Well, I call it worse than that, actually.
Explain to younger people listening maybe what illegitimate meant in practical terms.
Well, illegitimate meant that your child was not considered to have the same legal status as children who were born inside wedlock. So, but the weird thing was that technically I was still married, because of course we didn't have divorce. So there was a whole big hullabaloo about my daughter's father being able to sign the birth certificate, and I just kept stamping my foot. And in fact, he did get to sign the birth certificate. And then I went to my employer, UCD, by the way, it's UCD I spent my time in. I went to my employer and I said, you know, my daughter is not going to be able to benefit from my pension in the event of what they called my untimely death. I had to think about things like that.
Yeah.
And because she's illegitimate. And that caused another great big fuss. And I can remember very plainly, the registrar of UCD said to me, to my face, well, he said, Alfred, there's a very simple way you can correct this. You can adopt your daughter. I said, I beg your pardon. I made her myself by hand. I am not going to adopt my own child. So I contacted my union, SIPTU. Ultimately, the Chester Beatty Library took a case, and that whole system was changed for the public service. So that
absolutely Orwellian, wasn't it?
It was completely appalling. It was.
And was UCD not a you know, the way people kind of blame, in inverted commas, universities for, you know, liberalism and wokeness and all that?
Please.
Was UCD a liberal environment?
Well, UCD has never been a liberal environment.
Okay, they would probably argue with that.
They would. But no, but let's be very honest. Universities are huge institutions with a great deal of power. They continue to be in many ways very patriarchal institutions. And I would honestly say that one of the most difficult things I had to contend with as a young woman, and really throughout my career, was actually dealing with an academic institution that really did not value women on the same basis as men. I want to think that's changed. I hope it has changed. But it was very, very difficult. Very.
And so your activism was not something that they welcomed, was it? When you started
absolutely
making
noise?
Absolutely not.
No. Okay. And in fact, I had to fight very hard for the small promotions that I got. And I mean, ultimately, UCD suggested that I might wish to leave several years before my retirement. So I hold no brief for that notion that academic institutions are somehow essentially liberal. You have to fight to raise perhaps not just your liberal, but certainly your radical voice. You really do.
Okay. So you raised your radical voice then. If we bring people back to the 80s, again, it's extraordinary to think about it now. So the abortion referendum in 83, which enshrined the equal right of the unborn and the right of the mother's life. So you lost that one. The divorce, yes, in 86, was that was Hello Divorce, Goodbye Daddy, was it? And
yes.
And that one lost as well. It must have been a very disheartening time for you, was it?
The 80s were terrible, Brendan. You know, for those of us who were trying to fight to bring Ireland somehow into the second half of the 20th century, that was the decade that was most crushing. I mean, losing the abortion referendum, that was perhaps not a surprise. And in fact, in many ways, was really very important that there was an amendment, an anti-amendment campaign. We didn't want that amendment. And interestingly, a third of the electorate did vote against it. So there was some kind of glimmer there that people really were beginning to ask questions and to say, what kind of country is this? But when we came to divorce in 86, when, you know, so many thousands and thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people needed divorce.
You were still married, were you?
I was still married. I had a daughter who at that stage was age 9 or 10. And I was living with her father here in Dublin. And she was, I think, still at that time, that whole illegitimacy thing was still going through. And I mean, my situation was relatively okay. I mean, there were really dreadful situations going on. And the Irish electorate turned round and said no to divorce. It was the only time in my life that I said to myself, right, look, I'm out of here. I just can't stand this. We had been through the women's movement, the 70s, the early 80s. We had fought like absolute tigers. And I think the rest of the world, it seemed, was changing. Certainly Europe, North America, we were changing so fast. Ireland was trying, I think. You know, I can look back now and see that these were like Custer's last stands. Mm. But they were nonetheless experienced at the time as a kind of a country which was held in a sort of stasis, that it couldn't move, it couldn't look beyond its own navel, and that the Catholic Church was a hugely powerful component within all of that very authoritarian, repressive society that we were living in, and that those of us who were standing up against it, and we were many that were standing up against it, we were outcasts. We were kept on the margins.
Did you feel like that, yeah?
Yes, I did. I mean, I did.
Have you felt like that down the years at various times, like rejected by your own country, yeah?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, certainly the 80s I experienced, because, you know, there we were told, well, women can't make decisions about their own bodies in 83. In 86, we were told that we couldn't get divorced, that marriage was forever and ever and ever, when quite clearly all around us and in our own experience, it wasn't. And then at the end of the 80s, I came out, or I realised I was lesbian. It was really the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s. And I realised that nobody really wanted to know. People didn't want to know.
Really? Go on.
It was kind of a sense in which, sure, I can remember on RTE being introduced on Pro. I used to do a bit of broadcasting at the time. And I was asked, well, how will we introduce you? So I would always say something like, well, I'm an academic, I'm a feminist, and gay and lesbian was what we called it at the time, lesbian and gay activist. And invariably, I would be introduced as Ava Smith, UCD academic, and they would never say the words either feminist or, and certainly never mention the word maybe gay, never mention the word lesbian. Absolutely unspeakable.
Was lesbian worse than gay? It was
infinitely worse. It was. You're laughing, Brendan. That was life.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm not giving out to you. I'm saying that it seems so ridiculous and absurd to us now, but it was the great unmentionable. But so much was.
Was that difficult for your family as well then?
Oh, yes. But I mean, again, my family have always been very, you know, very supportive, really. But it was very hard for any family, any middle class family maybe, but I'm thinking just any family, to be able to stand there in, we'll say, 1991 or two or three or whatever, and say, my daughter is lesbian. And it wasn't, I wasn't thrown out of my family or anything like that. And yet, although many, many lesbian and gay people have been, and very sadly, it can still happen today, and trans people the same, you know, it is, that's a great sadness always that I think of, that people are disowned because of their sexuality, because of their gender identity, or indeed, that people are disowned and thrown out for any reason. It is the worst thing that you can do. We must all, I think, always have that open embrace, including for people who come to live here from elsewhere. You yeah. know? But just going.
So your parents stood by you?
Well, they certainly didn't desert me, but they found they couldn't understand. This was a world which had changed so fast. I mean, how could you have a child who was fighting for the right to abortion, who was fighting for the right to divorce, who was then saying she was lesbian, who had a daughter herself who was technically illegitimate, who was living with a man outside
wedlock. Is the word you're looking for, yeah.
Locked in. It's such a good phrase, yeah. Locked into it. And who then said, well, I'm not living with him anymore because actually I'm lesbian. So, you know, I do think that in that sense, my own life, just from my own very narrow little place where I stand in the world, I kind of sometimes feel as if so much of what we've been fighting for over my lifetime is kind of marked there, not by any means everything. But, you know, yeah. I had experiences of violence in my life as well, which I don't really talk about. Very difficult things. My daughter, when she was 11, went to live with her father in the north of Ireland.
This was after you came out?
After I came out.
That must have been very hard, was it?
That was the hardest thing that ever happened, I think, to me, in because of my politics and because of my life. It was very, very difficult, but I'm, you know, really very pleased to say that everybody ultimately dealt very well with all of it, including first class honours to my daughter, who is a wonderful woman and who is now raising my grandchildren in London.
Fabulous. It just keeps coming across what a hard road this was.
But that was very sad.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways, you know, I did get a lot of support and sympathy from very many people then, because I think, you know, everybody kind of realised that this is too cruel, this world is, we have to do something about that. But it was very difficult.
Yeah. So humanity, though.
Yes, and it does, it also teaches you a lot that if you take on the world one way and another, you do have to be prepared for the consequences. You really do. But it's not only you who may suffer. Other people may suffer too. And that was not easy for my daughter. That was very hard for her as well. And indeed for my former partner. So
yeah. So do you think then, as a feminist and as an activist, and do you think that men, and maybe women too in a way, felt you were some kind of threat, that you were going to want to tear down the status quo and their holy
yes.
lives and all that?
But
is that how it was seen, yeah?
Totally, but they were wrong. I mean, this is actually very definitely not just me, but hundreds and thousands of us, millions all over the world, you know, we do and we did and we still do want to ensure that there is an absolute, that there is absolute equality between women and men. And in order for that to be achieved, I mean, the world really has to be changed. It was a great cartoon I remember in the early days of the women's movement, was which went something like, women don't want equality with men, we're far more ambitious, which is actually about saying that in order to achieve that, you kind of have to change the whole world for that to happen. And that, of course, is the... is what we're still embarked on doing now.
Yeah.
Still.
Is part of the price you pay as well, and I'm conscious you're doing it again here now, but I suppose in a more reflective way and you're at a distance from it. And like we've seen it even in the recent referendum campaigns, that the way to change how people think is that women have to keep telling their stories and parading their scars and their pain. Is that a price people have paid as well?
Yes, I think that's probably true. Whenever you want to change people's minds, it's not just true of women. There is always that sense that there has to be, you've got to really touch people's hearts and emotions, that it's about affect as much as it is about so-called reason.
But not without cost to the people doing it, is it?
Yes, but that is a high cost. And I've always found that very, distasteful isn't even a strong enough word. I've never, ever, ever liked that. All during the many decades when, you know, three, four decades when I was campaigning around abortion, and we're still campaigning around that, by the way, but of journalists, particularly from elsewhere, would come and say, oh, well, we need to speak to a woman who's had an abortion. And I can remember saying to one journalist, we do not supply wombs with a view. This is not what this is about. This is about structures. This is about systems. This is about repression. But of course, that sense that it is the human experience, that's what moves people to open up their minds. And I think that's probably the case right across the board. I wish we could do our politics in other ways. I really do. I don't think that we should have to parade our experiences. However, I would also want to say that, you know, during the repeal referendum, what was extraordinary was the numbers of women who did tell their stories and for whom that was very positive. It was like this big catharsis that...
The shame is on the other side, almost.
Exactly, that they could break that silence, even if they still stayed anonymous, that they could break a silence. And I think it's combating the silence. I always, you know, I look back on my own life and I think that it's really been about breaking silence. It's been about all of us being able to stand up and speak out and very often to shout out. People don't like it when women shout because we're supposed to be polite and nice and good. And I think that one of the great things that we have gained, and I look at young women now, I think of, you know, young Natasha O'Brien in Limerick and Nikita Hand in court against Conor McGregor. And I think of that brave woman who stood up against the Garda, William Ryan, the other day. These women are standing up there and they're saying we are not keeping quiet about what is being done to us. All of the women who come, you know, to the organisations, whether it's Rape Crisis, whether it's Women's Aid, whatever it is, they're not putting up with this. They're not accepting that they have to stay quiet. That is the huge breakthrough.
So there were all these other problems under the covers, but
over
the toxic thing over it was the blanket of silence in Ireland, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. That was kept firmly in place by institutions like the church in collusion with the government, with the state. You only have to look at the whole horror of the mother and baby home saga. I mean, that was terrible. That, I think, is the most cruel thing. That separation, you know, it has always resonated so strongly with us. This terrible, terrible separation and making women, casting women aside for being themselves. I mean, that that's casting any person aside for being themselves is absolutely unacceptable.
Do you worry at all? We're 10 years on from, say, marriage equality, which you were very involved in too, of course. Do you worry, and, you know, we were talking earlier about the tectonic plates of the world shifting, that there, yes. is there a backlash happening against all the progress?
You know, I think I can honestly say, and I'm heading for 79, it's quite a long life, you know, that I have never been as afraid in my life of what is coming down the line for the world as a whole, but for people who reject brutality and violence and inequality and injustice. I mean, I just see us, people say, oh, there's a bit of a slide to the right. It's not a slide. It's like there's this huge accelerated rush towards the right, but far right, not beyond moderate, something which is about greed and narcissism and is quite brutal, is quite cruel. And you see that so clearly if you look at the huge gap that there is now between the obscenely wealthy and the equally appallingly poor. That gap is growing wider and wider all the time. So there's a huge chasm opening up where there's the mass of humanity and there are the wealthy few, which we see being played out before us in the US at the moment. And you put that on top of planetary destruction, the destruction of our planet. And I can honestly say I feel absolutely terrified. And I look at what is happening to, you know, when I look at what's happening to LGBT people, particularly to trans people, more in other parts of the world, maybe than here. I think we're holding a line here. But it is so important that we not let go of a system of values and morality, which actually places a value on every human being and says every human being is important. I don't normally speak in such macro terms, Brendan, really, but I do feel that we are at an incredibly important point, just thinking about Ireland, where what we need to do is to stand up and speak out against, for example, the war against Palestinians in Gaza, that we hold our line, that we speak out against the horror of what the President of the United States of America is now announcing, even in relation to Ukraine as well as to Gaza, in this desire to be master of the world and the universe by rendering economically insolvent the rest of the world, in effect. That this is a time when we have to be very clear that we are very small, but we intend to be very fierce.
So you mentioned there you were 79, so you're still looking
nearly,
for fights.
Nearly, not quite.
At 79, sorry, right. Now, I've just seen here all the texts. What a wonderful conversation with Alvitz. It goes to show how primitive and ignorant our system was. At the time, I totally agree with Alvitz. The 80s were so grey and oppressive for many women in Ireland. In my 50s, I still struggled to feel a sense of worth as a woman. She was so courageous to stand out. That's from Aisling. Congratulations to Alva Smith on such a wonderful award. The fight and the struggle goes on. Someone says, Alva was my French language tutor in UCD from 1980 to 83. Always admired her. Followed her battles through the 80s. Was delighted to see her at the marriage referendum celebrations and abortion amendment results. So proud of you, Alva. What an honour to hear her speak this morning. Alva has changed the path for so many women who did not have a voice, regardless of the background, and they go on and on. There's my daughter, now 36, is named Alva after Alva Smith.
That's
from Eddie. So you have one of the fights you're picking now is about getting older. Are we all very ageist?
We live in an incredibly ageist world. I can just tell you, you know, that the way in which you get dismissed. I was lying on a hospital trolley in A&E and a nurse was beside me and senior kind of person came in, nurse person came in, and looked over at this nurse and said, what is her problem? I said, excuse me, I'm here. I can tell you what my problem is myself. And, you know, I can speak up for myself. This is a very, very ageist place. And you put gender along with it. You put women's gender into it. And oh, my God.
Okay.
You know, it's just disgraceful.
Okay. We'll all be, let's be a bit more mindful on that. Alva, just before you go, do you wish you didn't have to do all that? Do you wish that you had grown up in a country that was more enlightened and more friendly to you?
Well,
and
that's pointless. I didn't. I grew up in the country I grew up in. I've lived all my life here. And actually, I really love Ireland. I like living in Ireland. I absolutely don't regret it at all. I think I have been incredibly privileged and fortunate in my life that I have been able, I had the education, I had the support, I had the background to be able to stand up, and it was never alone, always hundreds and hundreds and thousands of others to stand up and say, you know, it's not good enough, we're fighting on. And I consider that I've had a really very, I still have a very exciting life. I mean, you know, there's never a dull moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if we could all say that, fantastic. Alva Smith, thank you so much. And again, congratulations. There's one more text I'll read you. A person says, I have goosebumps listening to Alva. What courage and conviction. Wow. And you know what? I did too.
Thank you very much.
Alva Smith, thank you.